Thus far, our Prime Minister has admitted that climate change has had an influence on Australia's black summer. However, this opinion is based on the belief that this season is not profoundly different to any other. Well, of course, as Laura was reminding us, these simultaneous wildfires stretching from north to south, east to west, and actually something new and unrivalled in living memory. The precursor was, of course, the ongoing millennium drought, with the country registering its driest year with rainfall 40% lower than average, New South Wales registering its driest year ever, and the highest temperature on record. I was just filling out the last year's rain record at the farm before I came down for the program. We got 265 mils this year. That's been the pattern for the last three, incidentally. When in a good year we get 1,000 mil, and in an average year we get 600 to 700. Heavens above. New York Times columnist Paul Krugman described us as barreling down the road to hell, and a good indication of what awaits the rest of the world unless ultimately action is taken to reduce emissions. Now, in this segment, we want to explore if megafires are the new norm and whether we need to devise different ways of dealing with the aftermath, and I emphasise that, the aftermath of such a disaster. I'm joined now by Tom Griffiths. Tom's author and emeritus professor of history in the Research School of Social Sciences at the ANU. He's on the blower from Victoria. And with me, or with us in another mood, in our Canberra studio is Professor David Lindenmayer. David is from the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the ANU College of Science. If I may go to you first, David, do you agree with Krugman that unless a substantial action plan is taken to lower emissions, our black summers are the future? Not only for us, but pretty well everywhere?
Well, the results from work, for example, at the Hadley Centre in Europe suggest that he's right, that we're going to see substantially more climatic conditions that are going to underpin these severe kinds of fire seasons that we've already seen. And just to echo what you were saying at the beginning of the program, I've been doing fire research since the early 1980s and I have never seen a season anything even remotely like this, with fires in so many different places. And ecosystems
in that same era. I've been banging on since the early 80s about the reality of what we now choose to call climate change. And we always knew that something horrible was going to happen. But I must say the scale of it is simply breathtaking. I'm fascinated by something you've said elsewhere. In the absence of any climate change, the chances of four back-to-back days of 40 degrees are 1 in 16,000. With the changes in climate, the chance of four back-to-back 40-degree days are now 1 in 6. Heavens above.
It is extraordinary. And that work comes from an enormous amount of simulation modelling done by David Karoly and some of his colleagues, looking at past levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere relative to what we have now. And I even think about my own training at university when I was doing plant physiology. We were doing plant physiology experiments with the background levels of carbon dioxide at 300 parts per million. Now we're at pretty close to 415. And that's only, 30 years ago.
Such great scholars as Gerard Henderson insist that we've seen it all before. And it's true that we did have a mega fire which burnt over a million hectares, and that was back in 1939. But of course, since 2000, we've had a number.
That's correct. The 1939 fires burnt around about 3.4 million hectares. But that's the only one that we've had prior to 2000. Since 2000, we've had megafires, three megafires, and potentially now up to four. In that time. So we've actually seen in places such as Eastern Victoria a significant increase in the area burnt year on year on. And the important thing here is that it's not only the size of these fires, Philip, it's actually how frequently some of these areas are reburning. So again, in East Gippsland, we're seeing areas that burnt just 4 or 5 years ago being burnt at very high intensity and severity again. And some places have burnt 3 or 4 times in just 25 years.
I want to get back to, the complexity of burning patterns and the way that different parts of Australia burn differently. And there isn't a sort of one simple answer to everything. But before we do that, Tom, last year Britain, of all places, became the first country to declare a climate emergency. I'm a bit tired of the term tipping point, but from an historical perspective, has our continent and perhaps the entire planet reached a tipping point with a capital T and a capital P?
I'm afraid the evidence is that we have, Philip, yes. This fire season, I think, as we've been discussing, has drawn the attention of the whole world. This is a First Nation climate change disaster in a country with a denialist government, and it's attracted the attention of the world, and people are seeing this as a sign not just for us but also for the planet. And I agree.
So we're looking at something which is on a par with geophysical forces such as variations in the Earth's orbit or asteroid strikes.
Well, that's the impact humans now have on the planet, yes. And so I agree with what David said about this being an unprecedented fire season. And as a historian, you know, I shy away from the word unprecedented. We know too much about the past and there are so many parallels. And there is indeed a litany of black fire days in Australian history. You know, we've got a black day for every day of the week, many times over. But there's no doubt, as David's explained, I think, very well, that this year, this season, the smoke is worse, it's more widespread and more enduring. The fires are more extensive, they're more intense. New South Wales fires seem to me to be behaving like Victorian firestorms. And so instead of having one-off catastrophic events, black days, we are indeed, they've fused in this black and savage summer.
Tom, before I go back to David, it was recently revealed, I think in the AFR, that a national disaster risk reduction plan sat on the desk of the Minister for Home Affairs for 18 months, still hasn't been made public. Are you aware of it? Have you actually read it?
I've not read it, but it is true, I think, that the behaviour and inaction of our federal government has just compounded the agony and misery and trauma of this summer for many Australians. And you've been discussing with Laura the consequences of that for the Prime Minister standing. And I think one of the things that really has brought this home to Australians is that many of the iconic moments of drama are happening on our national place of theatre, the beach, the place where, you know, our identity is forged in a way, and a place where we go to for rest and renewal and reflection. And our summer's been taken away from us. People are returning from holidays that weren't holidays. Some people don't have homes to return to.
Tom, we know that there'll be long-term health effects, but the long-term mental health effects too. It'll take decades to sort of see those evolve.
That's true. And in the work that I've done with fire communities, particularly after Black Saturday, it's very important that we all remember that it's not just the trauma of the day or indeed of the summer, but people go on living in the difficult aftermath for many, many years. It's emotional, it's physical. And the national limelight swings away from them, and perhaps some of the help swings away from them, but they have to battle on, and it's a long, long journey.
David, let's look at aftermaths now. Is it time for a radical rethink about how we clean up after megafires? I know you're concerned with government plans to salvage and log the burnt forests.
Yes, that's right. One of the truly amazing things about the Australian bush is its ability to recover from some of these fires, including very high severity fires. We've seen that in just about every one of the dozen or so fires that I've worked on since the early 1980s. But what we do know is that if humans start to mess with some of these environments, it can massively impair the recovery process. So there's been an enormous outpouring of grief about Australia's wildlife, and rightly so. And some money has been invested in trying to conserve those animals. But if we start to mess up with these systems through salvage logging, so this is logging of burnt forest, those systems will take decades, if not centuries, to recover. We know that the impact on soils will be seen for 80 to 100 years. We've seen that with our own quantitative work. We know that some animals will not recover for 200 years if the forests are badly messed up by salvage logging after fires.
I've been waiting, worrying about rain coming, because what's going to happen is our fragile topsoil will sort of be washed into the rivers. We'll have rivers again. And, of course, we see a lot of it at the moment still just blowing away. But what about what happens underground? No one's talked about, and I'm curious to know, I know you're into soil, David, what about the fungal networks?
We know from work done after the 2009 fires, which actually traced back what happened after fires in 1939, and in fact after fires in 1850, we can still see the signal of fire effects and also logging effects that date back close to a century and perhaps even longer. And what happens is that the different kinds of fungi that perform very important roles in how forests function are radically altered by these major fire events, but also the changes that happen into forest soils with logging equipment. And so there are some really significant changes that happen in forests when humans start to disturb already fire-disturbed systems. And perhaps one of the really important stings in the tail is that when some of these forests are logged and then regenerated, that regenerating forest becomes quite fire-prone. And it's quite fire-prone for many, many decades afterwards, so that the memory in the forest of the previous logging and previous fire events can be sometimes very long, many decades.
Tom, back to you. The mountain and alpine ash that grow only in Victoria and Tasmania need to have explosive fires every 300 years in order to reproduce. It bursts their seeds out in crowning fires, and they've evolved to burn in firestorms. But Tom, they don't need them more often than that, do they? What happens with the mountain ash, for example, when the fires keep coming?
Well, as David explained, that we can lose the original forest and it can turn into acacia and scrub. And that has happened in large tracts of the Alps. And the firestorm, the Victorian firestorm, is a very particular type of fire, and it is fostered by a very particular kind of tree. And I feel as Australians we need to develop a more fine-grained and sophisticated language of fire. We're often reaching for national solutions or even statewide solutions. I would love to see the kind of ecological knowledge that I think David has produced. I'd like to see all of us learning that kind of language about the places in which we live and the forests with which we live.
I find this regional argument of yours very persuasive, because every region and forest has its own ecology. It's different from the Mallee to Mallacoota to the Blue Mountains to the Jarrah Forests of the West.
Exactly. And so Gerard Henderson got into trouble with his essay about trying to argue that we've had
no one attacks before. Gerard Henderson on this program.
I'm terribly sorry, Philip. But in reciting, you know, the history of the Victorian firestorm and believing that it might apply to all of Australia is exactly the kind of problem that we get into if you do generalise across fire ecologies and fire regimes. So, yes, we need every forest has a different kind of fire and a different kind of fire history. And one of the interesting things that happens in this kind of trauma and crisis is that we hear from people in the bush about what they know about where they live. And we should be listening to them. they have some wisdom there that we should pay attention to about the forest that they know well.
David, let's go back to you and your concerns about cleaning up afterwards. If logging in this fashion is a terrible mistake, what should we do?
What we should do is, where it's appropriate to do so for safety reasons, for human safety reasons, yes, by all means clean up. I get that. That's important. But where we don't need to do that, deeper in the bush, let the system recover. And what we've seen in previous fires has been really quite spectacular. Even after the Black Saturday fires in Victoria in 2009, you know, 80,000 kilowatts per square metre. You know, this is equivalent to what people were seeing in the Second World War after the massive bombs were dropped. We still had residual animals still surviving in little pockets, even where there seemed to be almost no green. And when we do the genetics work, we actually see that the recovering populations are founded on these small numbers of animals that have persisted in these incredibly intensely burnt areas.
And of course, we've got to factor in, I've talked about fungus because I have a fascination with the subject, but insect populations, what happens to them?
Well, some insect populations are utterly destroyed, but amazingly, some insects are attracted very strongly to these burning areas. These animals called jewel beetles, absolutely stunning creatures, have these little smoke detectors on their bodies. And they'll actually fly into where an area is burning because their life cycle is associated with these recently burned areas. So, for example, where we have carcasses of animals that have been killed, there'll be other animals, insects, that will start to colonise the carcass. So there's really quite an amazing biology that goes on in these places. And so it becomes really important for humans not to disturb that recovery process because it can be very strong. And we do see trees starting to resprout. Animals persist and then start to breed and to recover populations of plants and animals. It's really
the fecundity of insects is also terribly intriguing. I remember when Mount St. Helens blew and, you know, it was argued that it was going to take absolute centuries before Earth started to collect on that blasted landscape. But pretty shortly thereafter, something people hadn't factored in was that in the crevices, dead insects, the insects that were living and dying on Mount Helens, were creating a form of soil. And it just reminds us that everything is so absolutely interconnected.
Well, that's correct. In fact, I worked very closely with someone who studied Mount St. Helens. And what happened there was that parts of the landscape were actually underneath the snow at the time. And a whole range of beasties actually survived. And therein came these new ideas about how things start to recover, often from within the blast zone, and in our case, within the fire footprint, to start the recovery process. And that's really important for people who've been in these fire-damaged areas to see the hope that comes with how quickly the bush can start to bounce back.
David, you've estimated that during fires, soil temperatures reach 500 degrees.
That's correct. Yes, that's one of my PhD students who's almost finished some unbelievably fantastic work on the effects of fire and the effects of logging on the soil. And she's discovered that, in fact, the impacts below the soil surface can be even greater than above the soil surface, which is truly astounding.
Tom, we know a lot more than we used to know. What don't we know? Where would you like to see research money spent so we are better equipped in the future, or we understand, we don't make so many catastrophic mistakes?
Well, I think David Lindemeyer's a great example, actually. Fund the David Lindemeyer's of Australia. You know, people who have devoted their lives to the ecological understanding of particular forests and eco regions, that would be wonderful. That's where research would be very welcome. But also, I'd make a case for a need for research into the cultural history of fire. One of the most neglected areas of research in this field is that the human history of fire. And we're gradually now moving towards greater respect for Indigenous cultural burning. And I think that is very important for Indigenous land rights, for return to country, for fostering and renewing knowledge of country, and it'll have the useful side effect of encouraging not just Indigenous people, but all local people to interact with their bush through intelligent good fire and with ecological and historical knowledge, knowing where fire has been before, knowing what species benefit, and knowing how people can make it safe. And this is the kind of fine-grained knowledge of the bush that we as Australians need desperately to survive in the climate change world.
You're listening to Live, Late Night Live. We're back on air, alive and kicking. And my guests are author and emeritus professor of history in the Research School of Social Science at the ANU, Tom Griffiths, and Professor David Lindemeyer, Cameron Northbourne Avenue Studio is where he is, and he's from the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the ANU College of Science. David, picking up on Tom, do you have a view on Indigenous cultural burning?
I do, and it's a complex view, and I think Tom's spot on in his discussion about needing to appreciate more what's happened with Indigenous burning, and for Australians to really understand better where fire is at. And in, with those dialogues, I think it's going to be really important to help people recover.
Do I detect a hint of doubt, though, that there's that much to learn about Indigenous burning?
Oh, no, I think there's an enormous amount to learn. And I think it's very complex because we're talking about literally hundreds of different Indigenous nations who burnt country in different ways for different reasons. So a lot of the dialogue at the moment has been around Indigenous burning for hazard reduction reasons. But Indigenous people burnt for a whole lot of other reasons, for a whole lot of cultural reasons, for food gathering, for bringing in prey to hunt. And men and women burnt differently as well. One of my colleagues, David Bowman, said that he thought that one of the key things about Australian Aboriginal people was that they developed this concept of igniculture, where they were burning country for different reasons in different ways. Different groups burnt for different reasons. There were places that were totem places that weren't burnt at all. And we really only have a very limited understanding of that. But at the same time,
there's 40, 50,000 years of slowly acquired knowledge there that we should appreciate.
Yes, but it needs to be done in a culturally sensitive way, because I often think that what's happened is that white Australians, if we can call ourselves that, have often stolen knowledge, if we can call it that too, from Indigenous people without actually it being a fair dialogue and exchange of knowledge. And I think it's clearly things are different now in terms of the infrastructure that we have that wasn't there before. And the reasons why we might want to think about hazard reduction burning and what we can learn and what's relevant and what's not. So I think it's quite a complex set of issues that needs careful thought. When things are complex, we often need to slow down, not speed up, to make sure we get the right answer at the end.
About the slow process needed to restore complex situations, and I'd like to go back to that area where you insist that we need regional approaches every bit as much as state-based or federal.
Yes. Well, I think in Black Saturday we learned that national survival strategies could be fatal in a distinctively deadly fire region. I think that's the major thing we learned from Black Saturday, that defending your home may have been possible on certain days in many other regions and many other woodlands, but in the Black Saturday forests on a 40-plus degree day with a northerly ripping down on you, it was a fatal decision to try and stay and defend your home. So that taught us that we need to know. We need to have regional solutions and not just national solutions. Some things do lend themselves to national solutions. And I think there, as a result of Black Saturday, there was a national bushfire management policy statement that was signed off by COAG in 2012. And that contains many good recommendations that we haven't yet acted on. And I, I agree with your discussion with Laura that we don't need a Royal Commission when we already have had 57 inquiries since 1939.
Is that right? There's a total of 57?
That's right. And Kevin Tolhurst wrote a good essay about this recently, the fire ecologist, and really explaining it. He's given testimony to seven of these inquiries, and there is a lot of wisdom in the recommendations, most of which haven't yet been acted on. We don't need another Royal Commission. The fire authorities, I think, have acted extremely well and with great good sense throughout this crisis, unlike the government. And I think I would love to see those fire chiefs that the PM turned his back on in April. I'd love to see him now return to them and empower them and help them with the bushfire summit that they wanted almost a year ago.
David, the mountain ash forests of Victoria, it's where much of Melbourne's water supply comes from. However, the state-owned Vic forests have logged at a loss in the millions of dollars for years just to make paper.
That's correct. So for example, if we move to East Gippsland, where we've essentially got substantial amounts of fire at the moment, we know that Vic Forests has been losing well over $5 million year on for more than a decade. And so it's a very much an uneconomic industry at this stage. Now, the flip side of this, people will say, well, where are we going to get our wood from? Well, Victoria already produces 3.9 million tonnes of eucalypt pulp logs every year. But in an insane move, it actually exports 2.9 million tonnes of eucalypt pulp logs every year. So we could actually process that plantation timber within the state to make it into paper, remembering that 87% of everything that's logged in native forests in Victoria already goes into the pulp and wood chip stream. So we could actually process that material within Victoria and actually grow the number of jobs in the forest industry and actually start to move away from creating these very fire-prone young forests throughout the native forest estate. So there are solutions here, and they're economically good ones, and safety-wise, they're also very good ones to make.
David, what's a safe distance to consider when rebuilding houses near forests?
Well, we know that from the fire risk work that has been done in the mountain ash forest, that we shouldn't be logging anywhere near settlements. So that's between 1 to 5 kilometres from those settlements. A safe distance in terms of rebuild, that's beyond my area of expertise. What I do know is that from house loss work done in 2012 after the 2009 fires, hazard reduction burning is effective, but it needs to be within about a kilometre of where houses are, and that hazard reduction burning needs to be done about every 3 to 5 years.
Tom, an article you wrote recently noted, and I find this almost hard to say, that 2/3 of the world's wildlife have been destroyed in the past 50 years.
It's a terrible, terrible fact, isn't it? And it makes us realise what a momentous period of history that we're living through. And another fact that really took me back, Philip, was, and here we go back to 1980s when you established the Commission of the Future and put the greenhouse effect on the agenda. You know, since the 1980s, when humans first understood the urgency of the climate crisis, total historical carbon emissions since the Industrial Revolution have doubled. Now, what that means is that this crisis is of our making in our own lifetimes, and that responsibility still lies very much with us.
Gentlemen, we've got to wind it up, and I thank you very much for your time, both of you. David Lindemeyer, Professor David, I should remind you, is from the ANU, and Emeritus Professor of History, Tom Griffiths. It's been terrific.